oh, look at all these like hot, sexy Asian guys. And it's like, yeah, great. I want to see that for sure. This is like my, you know, brush with startup royalty, right? That we were able to raise like $1.3 million. By the time the article actually came out in like late September, like our company was like in a total sort of like tailspin.
Hi, I'm Paul Kwan, and this is the first episode of Fund BMC. And we're lucky enough to have as our first guest, Jason Shen. He came all the way from New York. I've known Jason for, I guess, almost a decade now. First kind of surfaced in the world here in the Valley with his blog, The Art of Ass Kicking. And Jason is a kick-ass founder. So he started a bunch of companies. We can talk about all of that. He's gone through some, you know, pretty long journeys with those companies. The first being RideJoy. Second one is Headlight, which is in the recruiting space. It's my background. And then his current company is called Midgame. It's in the game industry, which I used to work in as well. So here's Jason.
Hey, really excited to have you, be on. I almost said have you, but you're having me.
Yeah,
so.
we have to come up with.
So yeah, I mean, where to begin, right?
Like,
I
mean, as far back as
let's
you want.
Let's go far. I started doing gymnastics at the age of six.
Wow.
You know, partly my mom was a gymnastics coach.
Okay.
And so there was like an opportunity to kind of get free daycare, as it were. Like, we'll just throw you in a class. Yeah. But, you know, so the first couple of years, no good. Start to get good. Like, start competing at age 8, 9, 10, start getting better. And sort of like 10 was really a breakthrough year because when I was 11, I entered my first national competition.
Wow.
And that was like a big turning point for me. For me, it was a great experience, right? I knew I wanted to train for the highest level of sport. I wanted 2008 Olympics was a goal of mine, and it, I thought I would continue to grow in college, but you know, I had a couple sort of injuries and setbacks and things that kind of held me back from being able to compete. There were some smaller things, and then I had a big injury my junior year in college where I blew out my knee, like total dislocation, multiple surgeries, multiple like cadaver Achilles like reconstructions. And so that sort of dashed the possibility of, you know, international competition representing the United States. Because of my injury, I stayed a fifth year. In that fifth year, I was voted as captain by by my teammates. And we did win the national championship in 2009. So that was like a really great way to kind of cap off that career.
I mean, I think that says a lot about your leadership too, because you're co-captain selected by your teammates.
Yeah.
Right. But like for you, like you were world class, I would say, in a few things. And like when we're funding founders, we're always looking for people who are world class. And I think people don't understand what world class means. Like you hold two world records, right?
Yes.
Like, why would you do that? Like I saw the videos. It looks super hard. Like you did like 50 Aztec pushups. I don't think I could do one.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about, the story there is really just like, it's kind of like fun to challenge myself and that sort of a mentality that, you know, every sort of like downside gives you an upside. Like we won the national championship, but I re-injured my knee the week before the national championship. So I didn't get to compete. I was competing all season, but I didn't get to compete on the final day that we won. Right. And I think that not being able to like complete that has driven a lot of my, like, you know, I've run a marathon, you know, I've done these like athletic endeavors to try to like prove to myself or others or whatever that, like, you know, I have something still, you know, that I deserve to have been part of that ceremony where we win and all that. There are three types of sports. There are individual performance sports, dual competition sports, and team competition sports.
Dual meaning like one-on-one?
One-on-one.
Yeah.
You know, to sort of add some nuance to that, I think each of those types of sports imbues a different kind of mentality into the person, right? And so individual sports really focuses on, it's all sort of in your control, right? Other people don't even really matter that much, like minor sort of elements. And so really it's like you focus on your own training, on getting better, learning, because all of it sort of like, it's just like, if you're good enough, then you're good enough. Mm-hmm. Then you beat everybody else, right? Dual sports helps you understand that like there are other dynamics at play, right? Like you your opponent has weaknesses that you can sort of tap into, right? You can sort of study them, study their strategies, and then like look for ways to overcome them. Mm-hmm. And you know, competition matters a lot more. There's like these personal rivalries potentially with someone who's beaten you, but you want to beat them. And so it's like, it's not just what you are doing, it is what they're doing, right? And they can kind of screw with you in the same way that you're trying to screw with them. So you're sort of like also on the defensive, trying to like watch out for what they're trying to do to you. Right. Then you've got the team sports, which has some of the same dynamics as the individual competitive looking for weaknesses. But it's also about your own team's sort of dynamics, right? And like, are you on the same page? Do you have a coherent strategy? Do you trust your leader? Do you trust your coach? And like you can fall apart internally outside of what the other team is doing, right? And so there can be like a broader collapse.
Yeah.
So anyway, gymnastics was, as an individual, like I had to, I think, internalize, and I've been trying to sort of, in some ways, like not is relearn out of those habits of just like, hey, focus on yourself, focus on what you do and what you're doing, because that's all that matters. Mm-hmm. When in reality, I think the world is much more of a like the team dynamic, right? Especially when you talk about companies and founders. And I only know this because there was a book written about our batch of Y Combinator. It's called The Launchpad. It's called The Launchpad, and it's by Randall Strauss, who is a professor at San Jose State, I think, and also is like a business journalist. They take us in, they accept us, but they were in their notes, they're gonna pivot, we'll just back whatever they do next.
Really?
That's basically what we learned.
Yeah.
We were like, oh God, you know, what are we doing? We want to pivot. And they were just like, yeah, whatever. We knew this was gonna happen. So we ended up with long distance rides because we liked road trips, we liked like ride sharing. I mean, and it felt like something that was similar to Airbnb in that like open-ended space. This is before Lyft.
Back then, I would say Ridejoy and Zimride were intra-city distances. And then Uber was fighting head-to-head with the taxis and black cars with intercity travel, like within New York City, within San Francisco. You guys were going like SF to LA.
SF to LA, Portland, Seattle, those routes. And so during the program, we basically said, how do we get some initial traction? We launched a rideshare site for Burning Man. Mm-hmm. And it was very targeted towards Burning Man people. It got... You know, these are like one of those fortuitous life events where it's like, does it happen? Does it not happen? Like some, you know, the Burning Man Facebook page shared our site, burningmanrides.com, which then got, you know, a ton of traffic to the site and a lot of usage and people posting and submitting. And so we had this chart that went up into the right, right? If that hadn't happened, I mean, I don't think we would have had the company, you know, to be honest, right?
But so that literally could have only happened in San Francisco.
Right. Yeah, we were in the right place, right time. That worked enough to kind of bring the, you know, we were able to raise like $1.3 million in a sort of seed.
Yeah.
What back then was called
us. Was a seed round.
You know, a solid seed round, yeah, right? Totally. Yeah. So.
You guys were in, I remember like some article, I forgot which magazine, like Forbes or Fortune or something. It's like the three of you, it was Jessica, it was Paul.
So it's Vanity Fair.
Vanity Fair.
And so the story is, right, like this goes back to the journalist. Yeah. The journalist was in our cohort, followed all the companies in the batch, would like interview them and talk to them, and then wrote this book. And the book's first chapter is on, like the first two sentences are name-checking Randy, Calvin, and me. The photo, it takes place in South Park, San Francisco. Yeah. This is like
Tesla, right?
Yeah. This is like, yeah, and it's crazy that Tesla's already there back then. So there's like a Tesla, the like trunk is open, the front trunk, and like someone's like sitting inside, someone's like standing with the like trunk back, like propping it open. Someone's sitting in the car kind of like this. Calvin's sitting in the front with like our Ride Joy t-shirt, and then I'm like leaning up against a tree.
Right.
And on the other side of that tree is Drew Houston and Arash from Dropbox. Because their name checked.
Never heard of those guys.
Yeah, never heard of them. Because their name checked as like the success. So it was, and then it was Paul Graham, Jessica, and like the partners. Yeah. So it was sort of like, this is like my, you know, brush with startup royalty, right? Yeah. Valley royalty. It's like, you know, Paul Graham and those folks, sort of like the creator for Y Combinator, the successful sort of like early, you know,
well,
founders.
Still today, one of the most successful.
Yes, but early in the sense that they, you know, they were already successful even then, yeah. Right? And then the like upstart, the new
next
crew,
gen.
You know, next yeah. gen. Yeah, that was us. So it's just like, and that photo is framed in the YC halls, you know,
really?
So like, you know, raise the money. We had this office, we had like, you know, 6-7 people. We just launched the iPhone app and we do this photo shoot and it's like really exciting. By the time the article actually came out in like late September, like our company was like in a total sort of like tailspin because of what was going on with like, we had lost this huge source of traffic from mm-hmm. Craigslist. And so by the time the like paper came out, people were like, oh, I saw you in Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
That's like so exciting.
Yeah.
We were like, yeah, super exciting. And so we made the hard decision to let go of the staff that we had hired on. We gave them, you know, reasonably good severances. We gave them sort of, you know, recommendations into the YC community, into everyone we knew, and you know, put them on their feet. But it was a tough day, you know, to like come in and there were tears and, you know, it was like very sad. It felt very sudden, but it's one of those things where it's like, we didn't want it to drag on. We ultimately folded the business and returned some capital back to investors, which is very rare in the Valley. And
I mean, like, I've, you know, some companies and investors just go, yeah, don't worry about it. They don't want the money back.
They don't want the money back.
It's, I mean, sometimes more of a hassle.
Right. And so what's sort of funny is that you get two perspectives on this, right? You get people who hear that and they go, that was a responsible thing to do. It must not have been easy, but like that was like the right thing.
Sure.
And there are other people who might not say this to my face, but are thinking like, you couldn't think of something to do with the money? Like what kind of sort of like, you know, it's almost like you weren't gutsy enough or you weren't bold enough to just like do something, right? And so those are two mentalities to have, like what kind of steward do you want to be with your investors' money? / what is the risk reward profile that you're actually pursuing? And do you understand what the venture game is about?
Right.
And I think, you know, I've been in all, you know, that's a personal decision you have to make about how you want to play it. Right. And then in that case, we wanted to be stewards of our investors' money and recognize that when, you know, this wasn't going to work, this isn't going to work. And we're not going to try to like, just like throw it on some like crazy experiment that we had no belief was going to work.
So most companies don't make it. Almost every company, even when they get funding and have all the money in the world, it's kind of hair on fire every day, right?
That's right. And I think that's what shocks a lot of people who want to get into startups, especially work for startups, because they think on the outside it looks so good,
right?
And it's a shit show inside. This is maybe cynical or what, but like there is value even in a company that fails. Like the Fab guy, right? Fab, you know, flash sales, raised so much money. He'd like started another company, raised a ton of money and also failed.
Yeah.
And then he raised Fab and like Fab was growing super fast and then it failed. And like, even when you hear about WeWork, right? Like people will be like, well, they still built an $8 billion company or $12 billion company. It's like, well, when you take $15 billion worth of money, you
better build something.
And you build an $8 billion company that's like not that impressive. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, there is some, that person can be like, we still created a lot of value. You know, we still had, you know, tens of thousands of like, you know, offices all over the world and blah, blah, blah. It, like you can say the high level vanity numbers without the sort of investment required to do that. And it still gives you credit. And so there's this like perverse incentive to say like, well, hey, I should raise money anyway, because, you know, I can sort of like take, you know, credit for these things that I took other people's money to spend to build, even if I do it sort of shoddily and poorly, the raw numbers still look good,
right?
It only looks bad when you're like, wait, it took you that much money to do it. So there is, that's like part of the downside, I think, of the Valley, is that it doesn't reward the bootstrapper as much, who's capital efficient.
Yeah.
And then you got the handful of folks like, you know, DHH and Jason Fried and like Indie VC and mm-hmm. these other things that have, so there's been a counter push
yeah.
in that, right? And like indie hackers. But you know, there's no vested interest in celebrating that, mm-hmm. right? VCs have the money and media has the sort of like, you know, people want to write about the things that are big and that are everywhere,
yeah.
right? And so sort of the niche things don't have champions in the same way that the sort of big things do. So there's this weird world that sort of circulates around all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think being in the VC game, like I'm basically employed by VCs, right? When they raise money, when these startups raise money, the first thing they do is call me to mm-hmm. go spend it.
Yeah.
And I've spent millions, if not hundreds of millions, running recruiting programs for all these big companies. So I understand the game. And I think most people, hopefully, that are watching this know that, you know, there's these expectations once you get on that fundraising treadmill. And if it doesn't go well, it becomes this VC death spiral. Yeah. And we've seen it play over and over again. It's happened every decade since I've been here. And people always hand-wring and say, but tell me about kind of like, you know, going from that experience to, I think you worked in government, like
yeah,
presidential so innovation.
Did this tech fellowship called the Presidential Innovation Fellowship. It was started by under the Obama administration mm-hmm. to bring more entrepreneurs and tech folks inside the federal government. Just to gloss on the Smithsonian, what was great about working in government was like you could take all the best practices from tech and not innovate and just be like, I know this will work. I know sending emails to users segmented will work. I know that adding like a progress bar on these like pages will work. You know, I know that if we have these sorts of things set up, these incentives for like completing certain things, it will work because you just like, that's like standard operating yeah. practice, right? And they were so sort of a bit behind on some of those practices. And so you could just sort of run the standard playbook all day and just get wins,
wow.
right? Which was kind of fun, but then you're kind of like, well, I'm not learning anything now because I'm just sort of taking what worked. I was part of a class of 40 folks who had done that. I was like one on the young side, right? I was like 27. Mm-hmm. I was like probably the third youngest person there. Everyone else was in their 30s, 40s, 50s. You know, in Silicon Valley, it's sort of like youth is so important and right. so valued. And then in government, it was sort of like the reverse. They're like, what do you know? What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Someone said to my face in a meeting, like in an introductory meeting, they were like, I don't mean to sound ageist, but you don't look like you've graduated from college. Which is such an offensive thing to yeah. say.
Did you say, okay, boomer?
Yeah, I didn't have my clap back then.
Oh.
Right? But you know, I mean, I think it was also a bit racially charged mm. because as Asian people,
yeah.
you know, we can look younger.
Yeah.
What is this? How is this relevant to yeah. the conversation? Like, this is like an observation you want to make
yeah.
for no reason. I think it came out of a sense of fear that, like, you're not going to be responsible with this work that you're doing. And that fear sort of emerged. You know, there's this like great leadership maxim that's like, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So I wrote this piece for Vox that was sort of saying, so Asian Americans, when you look at social psychology and research around how we evaluate groups of people,
mm-hmm.
We typically value them on two dimensions, competence and warmth. So competence is like how good you are, like how capable you are achieving goals, mm-hmm. right? Getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
And warmth is about like, how aligned are your goals and my goals? Like, do we share, do I trust you, right? Like, mm-hmm. do I trust you and are you capable? And so these two things are really important because we are, Asian Americans often fall into this sort of cold but competent model. And so basically it's like, I talked to the psychologist, Professor Susan Fiske, who mm-hmm. created this sort of framework at Princeton. And she was like, she said it like, I'll hire you to work at my company, but I don't want you to date my daughter.
Hmm.
That was the sort of mentality, right? Which is like so apt in so many ways.
Wow.
Right?
I mean, like I can imagine somebody saying that,
right?
Like
right?
that's the world we live in today.
So anyway, so like that aside, let's talk a little bit about the study.
Hmm.
This was born out of a conversation I had with a friend of mine from high school She and Zhu, he and I and a couple other guys were all sort of like the Asian group that hung out together. Mm-hmm. He went on to medical school residency, and he was in his sort of residency program when he reflected on the fact that he'd gotten out of a relationship where he was sort of kind of closeted. Like, she was pretty introverted, and so then he kind of stayed home a lot. Mm-hmm. And he's like a pretty social guy, pretty funny, goofy. At least that was just what I remember him. And even in med school, he was like that. But in, you know, sort of this residency program, he kind of shrunk in a little bit. And he realized that people were really seeing him as this sort of like Asian shell, like someone who doesn't talk, just like does, you know, not socializing. He was at like working one night, and you know, the attending, who's like the boss of the night, said something like, oh, we need to like adjust the dosage for this person. And he does some math in his head, and he's like, oh, we need, you know, 375 milliliters. And she was like, wow, can't believe you did that so fast. You know, thank God we have an Asian on our team.
Wow.
I was like,
thanks.
Really? You know, like that's what you want to say? Or that's how you. And he was back on the dating scene, right? And he was on Tinder and swiping, and he was just like, I am not getting matches. And I'm like, you know, and I have a, you know, friend who is a doctor who is, you know, on a empirical basis, less good looking than I am, but white, you know, and he's getting way more matches than me. Sure. It's just like, what's going on, right? So
it's the algorithm.
Right. It's the, I mean, and so there's a lot to unpack there, but I think what we were interested in was like understanding, like, is this a common experience? Are other people having this experience? Yeah. He wanted me to write about this type of stuff. I had sort of my own stories, and I was like, I don't know if I feel ready to write about it, because I want to make sure that like my experiences are valid. I mean, my experiences are valid, right? And that's one of the things I've learned. Mm. But at the time, I was very unsure and sort of afraid to step into this. So I was like, let's collect data.
Yeah.
Right? Like a PM, like, you know, someone.
So you're talking about dating and race, and like, it's a minefield. You don't want to just walk in there.
You don't want to just run in there, right? And so I put together a couple questions on a Google Doc and like in a Google form, and added things in other categories like, you know, family, like identity, you know, stereotypes in general, and just threw it out on social media. And I was like, maybe I'll get 20, 30 people to take it. You know, it'll help flesh it out. Right. And like, it got shared like crazy. I knew I had tapped into something very sort of like deep, right, in that moment. And that sort of like, that was like the Burning Man Rides moment of like, there's something here. There was someone who commented in the study saying, one of the things that I felt was that I never had a chance to be a young man as an Asian person. I was either sort of a boy child, like not fully like given credit for being an adult, or I was an older guy. You know, there was never this moment where I was like a young man in my own right, full of potential and promise and like someone to bet on. I was like either like underdeveloped and seemed like immature, or I was like, oh, you're kind of old now.
Wait, did I say that?
I don't think it was you.
It feels very like I can relate to that.
But you relate to
that. Yeah, because I went to college when I was 16.
Wow.
So for me, it's like,
that's crazy.
Immediate. It's like you were just like a kid in high school and like trying to hang out and trying to be cool. Obviously, I wasn't cool, but like trying to just be a regular kid.
Right.
And then like, I remember that summer, I turned 16. I'm like, holy crap. Like, I started college.
You know, men, generally speaking, can struggle with like having those sort of more, you know, emotionally vulnerable conversations, which is what you sort of need to do.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's really important. I think, obviously, as an immigrant kid growing up in New York, there weren't a ton of people that you could look up to, like role models. Like the old saying, like, you can't be what you can't see.
Yes.
So I took role models from other communities. So I was a huge hip hop head, right? And I still am. And again, that's why I like Randall Park so much.
Mm-hmm.
But like in your study, I remember like there weren't any common role models that we could share. And I think part of it is because the Asian community is so disparate, right? Like there's 25 different, you know, cultures that could be quantified as Asian America in the US. We're not just one group.
But it's creative associations is a very, exotic sort of like they're going to Asia, right? There's like two Asian Americans who go to Asia where it's like all these other Asians that are like so crazy. You know, like these people could basically be white if, you know, and it would just like, if you just change a bits of the story, it would sort of work.
But to your point, like movies have a huge impact, right?
Right.
We had, you had written an article about the new movie that just came out.
Always Be My Maybe.
Always Be My Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about that movie.
For me, what was so remarkable was that this film actually portrays an Asian American guy as a sort of lovable loser, which on its face sounds negative.
No, I like it. Tell, I mean, obviously, I know where this is going.
Right.
Like, I think in the startup world, at least, everybody's looking to fund these like Nick Youngs, right? And you have to match this like crazy like stereotype of what, you know, a founder is. And then like the lovable loser is the guy that everybody actually like roots for.
Right. People talked about Crazy Rich Asians as, oh, look at all these like hot, sexy Asian guys. And it's like, yeah, great. I want to see that for sure. But it's also like all of these guys are super rich, you know, and they're super ripped, you know, and they, you know, they're charming and like, you know, classy and sophisticated and all these things.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to be the love interest when you're wealthy, good looking and, you know, charming. The world often values specialists.
Yes.
And there's this book, Range, which is all about why generalists can surpass specialists in many ways. You know, I think in general, specialists are more brittle. I mean, that's the human species, right? It's like we are so adaptable, right? Like we've adapted to all these climates. We go underwater, we go into space. Mm-hmm. Like we're not the strongest or the sort of most hidebound or like the sharpest claws, but like we've been able to adapt and improvise.
Right.
And I think being a generalist means having a broader sort of expanse of tools and knowledge and networks to kind of like collect in and pull together what you need. You know, when I at various times when I was, so I got married in April. And when I was talking to investors prior to getting married or like right after getting married, I made sure to like talk about getting married a lot, right?
Really?
Because I would be like, oh yeah, you know, I'm like a month out from getting married. And they'd be like, oh, congratulations. It's so exciting. Like, tell me about your, you know, fiance or your wife. And that immediately started to humanize me. Right. I'm not just like another guy doing a pitch. I'm like a guy who's about to get married to the love of his life and like celebrate this like occasion. Right.
That's interesting. So the life story impacts your fundraising story.
I would go out of my way to sort of introduce that. And like, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking now, I'm like, man, I'm not doing enough of what I'm talking about in the some of the more recent conversations I've had. Right.
Yeah.
Because like, I, you know, the that's over.
Yeah.
Right. Now I need to talk about my honeymoon that's coming up.
Right.
That was a decision that I made, right? To not just be like, oh, I'm going to rattle off all the like successes I've had because I need you to care about me because I know that you probably are more likely to see me as an other than you are to see me as one of us, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's like a simple example.
Oh, that's really interesting because I think on the flip side, for me, when I was fundraising last year and into this year, I would almost purposely avoid talking about family.
Yeah.
And family for me is the most important thing. So like, it was hard to like not talk about, you know, my wife or my kids or any of that stuff.
Right.
Because in startup world, like that's a negative. Like, oh, how can you be focused on your company if you also have to like be a dad and you actually want to be a good dad versus like one of these guys that just has like resources available? And I think I know for certain when I talk to female founders that they go out of their way to not talk about relationships or like pregnancies or anything.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Because it's a double bind because, right, if you talk about these things, then it's like, oh, are you not focused on the business? But, and especially, you know, there's research that shows that for women, it's sort of like you can't win in either case, right? If you don't talk about it, you seem too hard ass.
Yeah.
And if you do talk about it, then it's like, oh, well, now. I made a video for Midgame that was like a promo of our product, GA. So this is my shirt. So it's Tails, Navi, Ghost, and GA.
All right, so give people a little background. Midgame is your latest startup.
Yeah, Midgame is an AI companion for gamers, and it allows you to sort of access information in real time using your voice. So you don't have to alt tap out of the game. You don't have to check your phone. You have to do all these things.
Yep.
You know, over time, we hope to allow you to even, you know, transform your gaming experience through your voice and through other means. So that's sort of like, it sort of like adds to that immersion and experience of playing video games, right? So GA is the name of our assistant. That's what you call it. And so I, you know, a lot of this is, you know, there's a lot of technology behind it. Sometimes the implementation is hard to experience if you can't use the assistant yourself right. for this game and you don't play this game or you don't, you know, it's just very hard to understand. A big part of a founder's job is to paint a vision and to help people like see what this could be.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, this came from a conversation with a friend who was like, shouldn't you be making some kind of promo thing that you can like help people? And I was like, you're right. Of course, I need to do that. So I went into Keynote and I like built out using the animations tool and iMovie, like a whole sort of like Apple style, like punchy, like fast, you know, 80-second, right? Like video that talks through, like, it's like the problem, you know, the solution, like how it works and like where it goes. Right. And you know, I'm really proud of it. And like, we posted on Reddit, it got like 650 upvotes on Reddit. Wow. And people were like, well, I really need this. When will it be ready? You know, I now like play that at the beginning of a lot of my conversations, right? Because I'm just like, if you don't know anything about what we're doing, this video will like help you understand, right? And it gets people fired up and people will be like, and that's a lot of what founders do, right? You're selling your vision, you're persuading people, you're convincing them to come on board to do this thing that doesn't exist yet, but could exist, will exist, might exist with the right sort of ingredients.
Well, I mean, I feel like in my role of recruiting, the pitch is we have this great big vision, we're gonna build this huge thing, but we can't build it without you.
That's right. Right.
The reason we're starting this podcast and the reason we want to bring on people like you, it's not a simple story anymore. It's not this kind of like, you know, five quotes that you get into an article, right? Like, this is real life. And a lot of us choose this life for various reasons. But at the end of the day, like, I think we all get measured upon what our impact is.
We are all sort of like bound together in these ways. And I think whether you're influencing like a few people or, you know, tens of people or hundreds of people, right? Like, that is the sort of ultimate legacy, right? All code will be rewritten.
Yes.
Companies will all sort of like be, you know, like all these things, but sort of those relationships are sort of what kind of like connects it all together.
Yeah. Jason's new company is called Mind Game. I don't know if the blog is still up. The Art of Ass Kicking.
The Art of Ass Kicking is still up. It's just my name, jasonchen.com. If you want to follow us, you can go to midgame.gg. GG stands for good games.
GG, well played. Say, yeah.
Yeah, well played. And then our Twitter handle is also midgamegg on Twitter. You can follow me. I'm Jason Chen, S-H-E-N. You know, on most things, I end up getting Jason Chen. So, you know, would love to hear from you if you want to learn more about what we're working on. The Asian Man Study is theasianamericanman.com. So that's also pretty easy to find. And hit me up. Let me know if you want to collaborate, explore more about what we're doing with building this assistant for video games. And I'd love to chat.
Awesome. Thank you, Jason, for coming. This is the first episode of Fun BMC. And we'll hope to do a lot more of these with very interesting people like Jason. Cool. I think we've covered a lot. It was awesome. I mean, like, we haven't seen each other in years.
Yeah.
I think jump right like, in. Hey, I'm in town. Like, let's get coffee. And I was like, cool, let's get coffee. But like, let's record the whole thing.
Right.
So thanks for being in game for this. I think it was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me on.